Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 158, recorded Monday, July 7th, 2014. Patrick Byrne. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by SmartThings, the easiest and most affordable way to create a smart home. Protect and control your home from anywhere with no contracts and no monthly fees. For 10% off of any home security kit, visit smartthings.com/twit and use the code TWIT10 at checkout. This is Triangulation. I'm Tanya Hall, filling in for Leo Laporte. This is where we talk to some of the most interesting people in technology and on the internet. Today, our guest is Patrick Byrne, who is an American entrepreneur, e-commerce pioneer, and the founder and CEO of Overstock.com. Welcome, Patrick.
Tanya, what an honor to be on your show again.
I'm so honored to be able to talk to you. I get really excited because you have such a dynamic presence and there's so much that people can learn about you. I don't think we could have enough interviews to exactly explore everything that you are doing and have done. But in this episode of Triangulation, I really want to talk about kind of not just what you're doing today, but I also want to backstep a little bit and talk about how you got started and a little bit more about you and kind of the grassroots of where you began.
Okay. Well, anything you want to talk about,
fair game.
Go ahead. I'm fair game. You shoot.
So you have talked about when you were really young, you had a really important mentor in your life.
I did.
You did. And it's somebody that I think would probably surprise a lot of people. It's a pretty popular person in business and finance. And your parents even let you skip school to hang out with him. Who is that?
Right. Well, it was kind of, you want me to tell you that story real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
When I was 13, I was a New England guy, Yankee, but we moved to Maryland. My father took a job at Geico, which was then an almost bankrupt insurance company, and this funny guy from Omaha started buying stock in the company. This guy no one had ever heard of, but I mean, well, his name had never been in the paper or anything, and he started showing up and staying with us. And my parents, quite unusually, would let me skip school. And he was so remarkably generous in that he would schedule, every time he came to the D.C. area, he would schedule sort of 2 or 3 hours to have a nice long lunch with me and talk with me. And I was 13 years old. And over a couple dozen conversations, he really formed the way I view the world. And then when I was in college, I saw his name in print for the first time. He had an essay published in Barron's. His name's Warren Buffett. And as life went on, this guy I knew, who I kind of thought of as this farmer from Nebraska who would show up and teach me about, you know, imagine somebody has an acre of land and it produces 440 bushels of corn and the price of corn. And he would teach me like that in these very simple examples. And I thought the guy was a farmer who knew something about the stock market. And then he gradually turned into this mythical figure, Warren Buffett.
Warren Buffett. I can't imagine a better, really mentor in your life. And I think that based on how you're turning out, that was probably very formative for you. It probably had a huge impact on some of the decisions you make. How much credit do you give to having such a mentor to some of the decisions you've made in your career?
Oh, I give enormous credit. I give 80% of the credit to my mom, another 60% to my dad, and another 50% to Buffett. And that all adds up to 190%. And then my bad decisions subtracted about 90%. So that leaves me the 100 that I've accomplished. But you can't give them enough credit. And Buffett, to have him as one's personal teacher and tutor, I call him my rabbi. And so whenever I've had a problem, business or sometimes personal, I'll write him a long, detailed letter spelling everything out. He always wants me to explain things carefully. He says, his buddy Charlie Munger says, if you go into a room and explain yourself to an orangutan, you come out smarter, because the act of organizing your thoughts and explaining them actually makes you smarter. And in that example, he would say he's the orangutan, but of course he's not the orangutan. He tries to teach with the Socratic method. And many times it is the case that I'd write something and I'd send it to him and then we talk. And he never really gives me an answer. He just asks me questions until the right answer is totally obvious. But and that's a great way to teach too. Other times when I'm too slow to get it, he'll come out and explain the right way to think about something.
So you talked about your parents crediting, you know, them for being such a powerful influence on you. Where did you make your decision to pursue Taekwondo and actually choose a career in boxing? Was that your parents' influence, or did Warren Buffett tell you that that's the choice you should make, or where did that come from?
Well, no, it came from, I'm the youngest and smallest of three boys, and I grew up having my butt whipped. My brothers learned to golf and play tennis and everything, but they would just pummel me so regularly that the only sports I really wanted to learn were wrestling and judo and karate and boxing and such. And depending on where we lived, when we moved to DC at Bethesda, Maryland, when I was 13, I did sort of take up there. There was boxing in DC and I could take advantage of it. And I learned to box, but I did a lot of other things. And there was a point I went back later to boxing when I was writing my doctoral dissertation. I thought I would go make my days half the day be thought, half the day be fought. So I was living kind of on the cheap somewhere and I was working on my dissertation, but I was also trying to make it as the great white dope. That turned out to be that's a tough way to make a living. But I got into at that point, I was living in LA. And I'd heard of these guys that this is a story I've never told publicly. I communicated with some guys who had brought Brazilian jiu-jitsu. This was about 1990. Some guys who had brought Brazilian jiu-jitsu to the United States. And they had choreographed a couple of fight scenes in movies like Lethal Weapon that I thought were good. And I had a black belt by then and stuff. And so I got in touch with them and started going and training with them. They also went on and became very famous. The guy's name was Hoist Gracie and Horian Gracie and Hickson and Hoyler. I used to train with the Gracies. And then just as I was leaving at the end, after 2 or 3 years, I was moving back east and they showed me this business plan. Somebody had come in with a business plan to start something like the World Boxing League, only it would be for something that had never existed before, open fighting, which is what Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu does. And they were calling it the UFC. And they asked me what I thought of this. And I said, gee, it looks like it might actually go someplace. Anyway, if anybody who's into mixed martial arts at all, in that name Gracie, and especially Hoist Gracie, he's this legendary figure. But to me, it was kind of funny. Hoist Gracie is a fun guy to go out on the town in LA with. You're going out with the Gracie brothers, with Hoist or Hickson and Horace. They're good guys to go out to nightclubs with, put it that way.
And what was your boxing name again? I have it here somewhere.
Oh, I was Patrick the Surgeon Byrne. My nom de guerre, I was Patrick the Surgeon Byrne. I wanted to go with Patrick Slash and Byrne, as in Slash and Byrne Agriculture. But my manager, who was trying to make me promotable, thought that was too cerebral. And he wanted to go with, and I had a very surgical style. And so he made me Patrick the Surgeon Byrne.
When I think of, although it is, you know, a great sport, my grandfather was a big fan of boxing. You're very cerebral. In fact, you know, speaking of which, you've got triple degrees at Dartmouth, Cambridge, Stanford.
Don't remind me.
So you're not all bronze and muscle and but you're also a very intellectual, and you actually have taught as well. You've been a professor, right?
Yes.
What seems like those are some really disconnected things that you've done in the past, from being, you know, a very physical, I can't think of, you know, any more physical sport than that, to being very cerebral when it comes to teaching. What made you decide to enter the world of business?
Well, interesting question. I started off as a teenager doing little entrepreneurial things, and I started a Christmas tree lot and a wreath selling bit. So I was always doing those little projects on the side of going on with in academia. And I was sick right after college, and I was very sick. And when I got out, I was kind of an invalid, and I needed something to I couldn't even really probably have held a regular job at that point. So I went to graduate school for what I thought was a year to study mathematical logic at Stanford. And then that led to something else and led to something else. So, but on the side, I was doing these business projects. The SNLs collapsed in the late 80s. My brother and I got into the business of buying bankruptcies from the government, the RTC, Resolution Trust Corporation. So I was doing these things on the side. I didn't really plan on going into academia. I did want to eventually finish the doctorate because I was so close. But I hadn't really planned on being a professor. And then I went off into business in 94. I became full-time in business for the first time, and I thought it was going to be for about a year. I was working on a project that I thought would take me a year. And ever since then, it's been like Al Pacino in Godfather 3. Every time I start to get out, they suck me back in.
That's a pretty good analogy there. I think, you know, I would say, though, that you're very far from being that kind of a leader. You definitely lead by embracing your employees and embracing those people around you. But you don't shy away from controversy. And I think, you know, you can look at your background and see that that reflects in Overstock.com, which you launched. Actually, it was you changed the name. It was a Discounts Direct, and then it became Overstock.com. What year was that?
There, 99. There was a flea market, a business that really had was in the flea market liquidation kind of business. They had a website, but the website didn't connect to anything. They didn't have products or a warehouse, and they went broke. And I bought a majority stake in this broke company, brought in new investors, recapitalized it, and a few months later, we fired the guy running it and the people around him, and then a few months later, we launched this website, October 99, called Overstock.com. But it was pretty much a different company by then. And in fact, I've often looked back and wondered whether I would have been just better off building it from scratch. Then I didn't realize how much I was going to inherit, how many problems I was going to inherit that I needed to, that was going to distract us for the first year or two. So in any case, that's the origin of Overstock.
And continued to grow. I've heard you say that your competition is Amazon, and that's who you consider. Is that still the case, that you consider Amazon your major competitor?
Yes. I mean, there aren't many general merchandise sites there out there. Amazon, eBay, and Overstock, I think, are the general merchandise sites out there, the main ones at this point, pure plays. You know, there's Walmart.com and Target.com and stuff, but they're brick and click. So I think of Amazon and eBay, although I don't really – I mean, Amazon is the competition, but given that our prices are on average about 10% cheaper and our customer service is better, I don't think of them as much competition. But I mean, in the sense of, I think we're hands down a better company. We're more profitable on a per share basis, an operating margin basis, a couple years ago, even on an absolute basis. So anyway, I like having them as a competitor.
The last time we talked, you gave some, per my persuasion, you gave some advice to the future of the leadership at Best Buy. So you mentioned brick and mortar to online. You mentioned Walmart specifically, and that was one of my questions for you, as I feel like, in my opinion, they have missed, although they do quite well online, I think they probably have missed some of the opportunity to really dominate the space. What do you think about Walmart's strategy as an online retailer?
Well, they have gotten very good. I think sort of by 06, 07, they got very good. Their initial strategy was sit back and wait it out and look at where this went. In 99, 2000, 2001, nobody even knew if there was going to be, you know, what was going to survive. And they didn't really hop into the game and try to compete then. They hung back and they took their time and figured out their strategy. But by around 06, Walmart and Target had both gotten very good websites built and had gotten really quite good at the game. And then when they started promoting in their stores, they had enormous success and they became quite big. The brick and click model is probably where the gods of economics really want everything to converge, is brick and click. We, Overstock, can't, because by its nature, well, we can't in any obvious way. But for example, there's been a rumor for a couple of years that Amazon's got a strategy. Someday they're going to open 400 stores or something. If they do, that's a reflection of really probably the where the gods of economics think is the best, most efficient system is some combination of brick and mortar retail along with an online website, because you can have these synergies between them.
But how would that affect your business model? Because isn't the bulk of your sales, like 80%, I think if you've heard you say, that is just direct to the retailer? So you basically take the order and you do not actually house the products themselves, or is that changing?
Actually, it's up to 90% now. And it's kind of funny because when we started off, it wasn't part of our business model at all. It started about 6 months into the game. We had somebody in Chicago who was selling us truckloads of, I think, vacuum cleaners and trucking them down every week. And we finally occurred to us, you know, instead of trucking them here, why don't we just open up the back end of our database? You can load up your product and we'll save that one whole leg. And that was the first partner. We did that in 2000, and that has become 90% of the business. We realized that we want to be the platform that enables the jobbers, the mom and pop, the liquidators, the mom and pops and the big jobbers, and the bankruptcies and such. We want to be the platform for them. So, but now it's stabilizing. I think we have always got to maintain the ability to buy ourselves, because there are some opportunities you just need to. And if maybe it's a bankruptcy, we're doing a lot of bankruptcies these days where people go bankrupt. We're working on another nice one. I think we have it, you know, not huge, a few million dollars, which is, you know, getting about, well, anyway, we're getting about we can in bankruptcy get sort of $30 million, stuff that is worth $30 million at the normal retail price. We might pick up for $3 million or so. But you need to be very specialized to be able to handle a bankruptcy, because you end up just getting truckloads of stuff all glommed together, and you got to have a warehouse where people can sort it. And it's a lot more high touch than like a normal, highly automated warehouse such as Amazon deals with. It's kind of a grubby, difficult area of retail, and that's part of the moat that you're not going to see in Amazon or anybody who's really dependent on having super efficient automated systems. They can't deal in this. They can't swim in this end of the pool.
Well, and you guys do a lot of different things that I don't think people realize when they just go to your website to purchase a rug or a sofa or whatever, which I always have something in my cart at Overstock. And I go back and add more and add more. So I need to just click purchase. But
you can't start saving money until you click purchase.
That's right.
And the more you spend, the more you save, Tanya. Don't forget that.
I know. So You know, you talked about this bankruptcy. I love how you work with the mom and pops, and you do focus a lot on helping those boutique agencies have an outlet to sell their products, and you showcase that. I think that makes it very unique for Overstock. It's kind of an Etsy kind of thing. The other thing that I think that I found really interesting is that you also have like a relationship with animal rescue and helping animals find homes, which I think is kind of, you know, random for an online retailer. What made you decide to focus on cause related, specifically animals and helping pets find home? Are you an animal lover?
Well, I never think of myself as an animal lover. I think I just have a normal relationship with animals. I don't pretend that they have any special affinity for me. I'm just a normal biped in their eyes. But I do have a few horses, found a couple little kittens in my barn last year, one of them with no eyes. And I took them inside, two sisters, and they're my best friends now. We have had these, I guess you would call it cause marketing, except we think of it as just the right thing to do, as corny as it sounds. For example, we've had since 2001 a department called WorldStock, where we have artisans, 10,000 artisans around the world earning their living selling us stuff that we sell on the internet. And we applied it a few years ago. We came up with another store called the Main Street Revolution. And these are all within Overstock. And the Main Street Revolution is going around to small entrepreneurs, hundreds of them in the United States, and getting them online. And for some of them, it really works. And suddenly they've got $250,000 of business they didn't have before, and a little mom and pop candy factory or something. So it makes a difference for them. And we did last November, actually, while I was doing yoga and my cats were crawling all over me. I got thinking, well, we've gotten very good at search, at in search technology, internal search. So when you come to the site and you type something, it's really much more of a science to getting that search engine to work well than you would think. And so the idea came to me, why don't we integrate it into 6,000 pet shelters around the country? So we get 200,000 animals that are in pet shelters at any given time, get them all together online in our search engine, and be the first guy that really lets you search quickly and thoroughly all the pet shelters in America just from one place. So, and then it occurred to us, well, now that we had World Stock and Main Street and Pets, and we're also starting to do food, those don't really fit the normal shopping, discount shopping model. So we've created a new tab we called O Village. And if you go up on Overstock now, there's a tab O Village, and it's all those businesses that aren't really about, you know, getting not all about discount shopping. It's about, you know, saving a pet or buying a nice bowl for your living room, but in a way that provides, you know, a week of employment to some woman in Nepal. There isn't any overarching strategy other than it seems like when you've got the ability to do something like that pretty easily, that you should go ahead and do it, because kind of the world's counting on somebody to do it.
And I love that you just get this idea and you're kind of, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to make it happen. And that is why I think you're so successful. You're not managed by fear. You're managed by passion, and you have certainly great mentors and people that you surround yourself with to help you make decisions. I want to talk about how you're kind of pioneering the space of Bitcoin and certainly this idea of cryptocurrency. But before we do, I want to talk about our sponsor for Triangulation. SmartThings is our sponsor today, and they are a super, super awesome technology. Speaking of tech, and it's what we talk about here, SmartThings makes it easy to protect and control your home with your smartphone. You can adjust the lights or the temperature, keep track of whether your kids come home from school on time, and even check to see if you remembered to close the garage door. You can do it from anywhere using your iOS or Android device. Start with one of the three smart home security kits, number one. Each kit comes with one SmartThings hub and enough sensors and outlets to turn your home into a smart home in as little as 15 minutes. That's right. Just plug the SmartThings hub into your router and add the sensors and outlets by following the instructions from the free and easy-to-use SmartThings app. In addition to SmartThings own sensors, you can add hundreds of other home automation devices from a variety of manufacturers like GE, Schlink, Honeywell, and Aeon, as well as the latest connected devices from Nest Thermostat, Philips Hue, Wemo, Sonos, and more. SmartThings also lets developers create new ways to use the product, then publishes these integrations and features in its app so that all its customers can use them. With thousands of developers adding new integrations all the time, you can update your smart home as often as you want to fit your preferences. SmartThings offers three home security kits, which they call Smart, Smarter, and Smartest. The Smart Home Security Kit is only $329. It includes one SmartThing hub, one SmartSense motion sensor, and one SmartSense presence sensor, and three SmartSense multi-sensors, which are multi-purpose sensors for doors, windows, drawers that sense when things are open and closed and can measure temperature, acceleration, vibration, that sort of thing. The Smart Home Security Kit is $479. It adds an additional motion sensor, a smart power outlet, and a siren strobe alarm. The Smart Sensor Home Security Kit is $599. It includes all of the above, plus another presence sensor power outlet, and an outdoor light plug and control power outlet. Each of these kits offers an affordable way to secure and automate your home without any of the contract's monitoring fees or hidden charges associated with traditional home security companies. So, to get started creating your smart home, visit smartthings.com/twit, and you can save 10% off the purchase of any home security kit by entering the code TWIT10 at checkout. You'll also get free shipping within the United States. That's smartthings.com/twit. And remember to use the code TWIT10 at checkout. Thank you, Smart Things, for hosting, for being the sponsor of this show. I love smart products and I love smart people. And we're talking to one of the world's smartest CEOs right now, Patrick Byrne. Oh, no, it's true. It's true. I wouldn't just say that.
I've got a fine horse under me. I've got a fine horse under me.
So I put a teaser that we were going to talk about cryptocurrency because that is something that is a passion of yours, but also something that's really confusing to almost everyone. And I don't think there's a lot of gray area. I think some people know a little bit, but most people either know some things as it changes, and some people don't know anything at all. So what is cryptocurrency?
Cryptocurrency, it need not be confusing, although the underlying technology is extremely cool, but extremely, you got to spend a while in school to understand it. It's the mathematics that underlies cryptography. If you've ever heard of Gödel, Kurt Gödel, the Austrian logician, there's an area of mathematics called computability theory. And which I happen to have studied for some reason in the course of my doctorate. And what somebody has done is, and nobody really knows who, Satoshi Nakamoto, did I pronounce that? Somebody figured out a way to create a currency based on these laws of mathematics that underline cryptography. So they call it cryptocurrency. And the currency is issued by no government. It's kind of a creation of the laws of mathematics rather than a creation of any government. And there are some real advantages to it, some business advantages, but really philosophical advantages that are why I'm supporting it and trying to do my little ant's share of pushing society towards the adoption of cryptocurrency, probably Bitcoin. Bitcoin has the first mover advantage, but there are others out there.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that that's partly where it gets a little bit confusing. And I would hardly say that you're doing your aunt's share. You're the first on the, you know, Overstock.com is the first online retailer to actually not only accept Bitcoin, but you've moved beyond accepting it. And you also offer, I think I heard it was 1%, but I think it's up to 3% to consumers who use Bitcoin. Is that true?
Well, no, we haven't actually gone live with that yet. We're going to be giving 1% back to consumers, and I think we're going to be giving 3%, although we haven't turned this on yet. We're working on the plumbing, but we'll be giving 3% back to the Bitcoin community to organizations that further the global adoption of Bitcoin. So that way, people who are into Bitcoin can just shop at Overstock, and you're getting, for every $100 you spend, you're getting $1 back, and $3 is going out to foundations and such who are trying to sort of fight the fight, the legal fights and such, to get Bitcoin and cryptocurrency accepted. Because there's all kinds of powerful, evil forces who want to see it stopped, who autocratic forces, you know, Russia and China have tried to essentially stop it in its tracks. You can't really outlaw it any more than you can outlaw mathematics. But those aren't live yet. I hope they'll be live by about September.
So, and to your point, I think if this was going to be outlawed, you think this would have happened a long time ago. I think this kind of really ramped up in popularity and began being used. And I think now it's a little, to your point, it's a little late. They can't change it. And again, this is a space that I know you're completely passionate about. And most people don't even know if they have any sort of digital currency value. So how does somebody find out, or how does somebody acquire digital currency?
You should go to a site like BitPay or Coinbase or Coinapult, or there are others now, and you get a wallet. Unless you're a real geek yourself. I call them dolphin speakers, the geeks who get together, and they don't need to deal with a company like that. They can just go directly. But you want to go to probably Coinbase or BitPay or Coinapult, and you sign up. It takes about 2 minutes. You link it to your bank account, and you can from then on, it's as easy as PayPal or easier. You can just link, move dollars out of your bank account into BitPay anytime you want. You keep some on into Bitcoin. You keep some on hand in Bitcoin, and then you shop, and in a couple of years you're going to be paying for your Starbucks with your cell phone with Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is going to start becoming much more ubiquitous in your life. But anyway, go to Coinbase, sign up for a wallet. It takes you 2 minutes, and it's really simple. It's unfamiliar and it sounds complicated, but it's really simple once you start using it. In fact, you're going to throw away your credit cards or not use your credit cards. It's easier, much easier than using your credit cards once you are signed up.
So let's talk about the impact that digital currency, cryptocurrency has overall, because there's not just Bitcoin. There are other currencies that are accepted, and I expect we'll see more. And it's, it's something that there's just not really any oversight, right? Like, so how is digital currency or cryptocurrency going to change, at least here in the United States, our the system and how we actually manage money?
Well, I start with a premise. I mean, we can talk about it if you want, but I'll start with the lemma. We live in an oligarchy. This country's history can be told as a competition between two power centers, Wall Street and Washington. About 30 years ago, Wall Street got Washington under their thumb. I've been in the belly of the beast. I have fought the fight. You may know I was a one-man Occupy Wall Street from about 2004. Actually, not one man. There were about a dozen folks on the internet that we all met each other, and we were trying, long before Occupy Wall Street came along, we figured out there was a lot of criminality going on Wall Street, where it was going on and such. Well, it centers on the settlement system, and organized crime has figured out that there are cracks in the nation's settlement system, stock settlement system. They're taking advantage of it. But what was curious to me was the reaction of the establishment, because we had the goods. We had the data, the evidence. We had people who took part in it. We had it all spelled out. We had lawyers and economists willing to, you know, talk to the powers that be and confirm this. And the fact that it was so hard, 05, 06, we knew there was a crash coming. We knew there was a crash coming. That's actually when I ended up going out and sinking a fair chunk of cash into gold, because I knew that there was a crash coming. And that actually became the kitty with which I have funded my assault on Wall Street. The thing is, these different games that keep the oligarchy alive are fueled by cracks. The financial system has far more cracks and far more sponginess than you have any idea is actually there. And it can only exist like that because they have centralized institutions that they can capture, that they can hijack. Now, this used to sound crazy. A New York Post used to run pictures of me with UFOs coming out of my head when I would talk about we're living in an oligarchy and our regulators that you think are protecting you are not. They're under the thumb of Wall Street and they're doing all these. We have these central institutions that have gotten captured. The cool thing about everything cryptocurrency, not everything, but about Bitcoin, is it's peer-to-peer. You don't need central institutions. You don't need central clearing institutions, central counterparty clearing. You don't need a central bank. In fact, you can't have a central bank. That is all a source for good. I recently saw Thomas Sowell, who's a great economist I admire out at Stanford and Hoover, was asked something about what would you do with a central bank? What would you do with the U.S. Federal Reserve, which is the name of our central bank? And he said, well, I'd shut it down tomorrow. And they said, well, what would you replace it with? And Sowell said, it's a tumor. It's like asking, well, what do you do with a tumor? You cut it out. Well, what do you replace it with? You don't replace it with anything. It's a tumor. Well, the Federal Reserve is a tumor on the economic life of America. Milton Friedman was asked in 1992, Minneapolis Federal Reserve, the Minneapolis branch. They asked him, what's the most important issue facing America? And he told them, most important issue facing America is, how do we get rid of you? How do we get rid of the Federal Reserve? So crypto is the answer. It's the Federal Reserve and an organization called the DTCC, which is the central clearing system underneath the stock market, are both corrupt. They're doing things that benefit the rich and impoverish the poor and the middle class. And they're, you know, they're not going to stop because we remonstrate with them, because we elect new officials or anything like that. It's far beyond anything that we, the citizens, can address through the normal mechanisms. What we can do is adopt a technology that gets your, that gets you out from these institutions that you don't trust anymore. So that's, it really is a world historical development, this crypto revolution. It's a world historical development. And what it will do is choke the, it'll turn off the oxygen hose that feeds the oligarchy, which is really hijacked our society.
So how long is it going to take to replace physical currency and our Federal Reserve with cryptocurrency, with, you know, this new way of buying and purchasing that bypasses the government?
Well, it's now growing. First, I don't think we have to completely replace it. You just have to develop. It's like with school choice. I'm a big supporter of school vouchers, another innovation of Milton Friedman. And it isn't like we want to need to get 100% of children onto voucher programs. Maybe you only need to get 10 or 15% for the system to reform itself and have to start playing true. Once enough people have defected, and that may only be 10 or 15%, that will force the school system, the government school system, to fix itself. Similarly, I don't think crypto has to take over the entire monetary system. It just has to become a robust alternative, and then it will start imposing some discipline on the current system. On the other hand, if it doesn't, and I'm really quite pessimistic, I think that whereas Warren Buffett likes to say some businesses go broke a long time before they run out of cash, well, to that I would add that's especially true when you're a business that can print the cash, which is, you know, the United States. You can print your own global reserve currency. So we may not look like we're broke, but we are broke. We are brokety broke broke. We're the brokest country in history. We're completely broke. We have a broken business model. The people who are back there in Washington just tinkering. The only people who understand, to me, what's going on are the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street guys. They're the only, now, both of them got, as organizations do, got pulled into some side, you know, the Occupy Wall Street goes out and endorses the Albanian Communist Party or frees somebody from jail and all kinds of stuff that's off mission. Their original point was that Wall Street has become too powerful and is corrupting our republic. And they're entirely correct. And it's something that the Tea Party can get behind. Milton Friedman used to say, when socialism comes to this country, it's not going to come from left-wing people. It's going to come from businessmen it's going to come from crony capitalism. Crony capitalism degenerates into socialism. So those are the only two groups that really understand, in my mind, what's going on in this country. And it's not going to take getting everyone to change their mind. It's just going to take the crypto revolution, providing a robust alternative so that when the current system fails, and sadly, I think that 2008 was just the amuse-bouche course. It was just a tiny hors d'oeuvre of what's to come. Nothing has been fixed. There's been no underlying reform. You just experienced the recovery. What you've had in the last 5 years, that was the recovery. Now, let me point out that in the second quarter of 2009, we ended the recession. The George Bush recession only lasted until the second quarter of 2009. We've been officially out of that recession for 5 years now. So and now we're slipping back into it. Q1 was a -3% growth. Let's see what Q2 is. I think the estimates out there are way too high. We'll see. But if it's another negative print, we are now officially, a recession is defined as 2 negative quarters. We'll be back into that in a few weeks when the numbers come out for Q2 if it's another negative print. If we have another 2008 like event, I think the country's going to be very happy that it has a robust alternative system that people can be tied into. and that would be crypto, Bitcoin.
Can't wait to use my Bitcoin at overstock.com to buy a new sofa, which is just something I've been saying I'm going to get for a long time. I don't even have a sofa. Seriously.
Well, I think it's time you do. I think it's time you have one. Time.
Individual seating only in my home. This is really crazy. So
that's not very romantic.
It is not romantic whatsoever. I need to change that. You have said, and I don't know if this is an influence from Warren Buffett, but I think most of us have some sort of strategy or plan personally as well as for our business on where we're going to be, where our goals are. We're seeing a lot of change. Certainly Amazon is trying to figure out what they want to be, and also Google Retail and online, you know, they're trying to kind of, you know, push further into the online shopping space. What is the strategy for Overstock.com to continue to be innovators, to continue to lead when it comes to taking chances and trying new things and being more aggressive when it comes to connecting consumers to products?
Well, part of it is international. We've also developed some way cool technology that we've just released a couple months ago domestically that makes us those small and mid-sized sellers and big sellers on eBay and Amazon Marketplace, we now have an alternative that I think is really attractive. We're drawing a lot of defection over, and it's just going to get more attractive. We have a good international strategy that we've built a platform that will, I think, now let us get international quite a bit more aggressively than in the past. But really what I focus on now is more is the internal institutions in the company. I know I don't have all the answers. I'm not my fear is being the Dilbert manager, the guy with the pointy hair sitting in this corner office thinking he knows everything and issuing edicts. That's not me. I'm thinking in terms of what institutions do we want to have that let the collective wisdom of our 1,500 colleagues express itself in and generate innovation and have the right decisions made and the right priorities set and get things done. So I sort of focus my mind on these internal institutions and then my 1,500 colleagues through their collective wisdom are more and more they're steering the company and the company's direction.
I think, you know, you certainly do have a great team and a lot of people, you know, at your organization. In fact, I think you announced the last time you were on Twit that you were hiring somebody. You just said, hey, we're looking for somebody. And did that work for you? Were we great recruiting outlet for you?
We got some resumes. We did. I know we got one that looked very good, and I don't know where it stands that we hire the person or not. But tell you who we're looking for now, looking for people out there who understand the crypto geeks, people who can do dolphin speak, you know, who are into the crypto revolution and want a place to come and be part of the core team, because we're going to be doing some other things, rather stunning things soon in regarding the crypto revolution. And we are building a team internally that's just going to work on these kind of crypto projects like Bitcoin, maybe some other coins. And I'd love anyone out there, any technologist who really knows this field, knows the blockchain, knows what a non-polynomial hard problem is and what Turing complete is and things like that. Those kind of people, if you know what Turing complete is and you'd be interested in moving to the great state of Utah, drop us an email.
I think you're speaking to the right audience of Twit listeners, because, you know, that's definitely right up their alley. So we'll see if you let me know if you get some response on that. You're very interesting and eclectic personality. You talked about how you have horses, and I know you live out, you know, you're not very social media active. Is that because you're trying to be more private, or because you don't seem like a private kind of guy? You're definitely, you know, not afraid to, offend the people in Wall Street for speaking your mind. In fact, you have a blog about that, speaking of social media, and you've actually received an award for your blog and website. Talk about that.
Deep Capture. DeepCapture.com started in 2007, but really picking up things I'd been writing and saying publicly since 04, 05. And it's a blog. I hired a couple professional journalists, and we investigate Wall Street. And it's basically been a blog to make the case of the capture of the East Coast establishment by the New York money interests. And it's won all kinds of awards as the best business investigative journalism on the internet, the best blog on corruption in the United States, things like this. And this won these various awards. We take on law firms, New York law firms, New York banks. We have all kinds of whistleblowers get in touch with us. So it's pretty far out there. It's going down the rabbit hole. If you want to go down the rabbit hole and really understand how things are working in this country under the hood, you ought to check out deepcapture.com. But as far as social media, the truth is it started when LinkedIn first started. I signed up with LinkedIn and I quickly started getting 200 invitations a day. And I just said, phooey, and I turned it off. And I've never been on Facebook. And I know I sound like your grandfather or something, but I'm not really a social guy. I don't want to go into, I'm going into this restaurant now or so. I don't want to do that. But I don't mind having my writing essays and having them appear publicly. And I love the opportunity to appear on your show, Tanya.
Oh, thank you. I take it you're not the mayor of your yoga, where you do the warm yoga. Do you have a yoga place at home? I imagine that your home, although out in the woods or out in the mountains or whatever, with your horses and your cats, which I think is actually completely adorable. I got this immediate visual image of a cat video with you with little kittens all around. Going viral. I'd love that. So if you ever just want to do a little quick viral video, I'm happy to post it for you on social media. You don't even have to do it.
Can I mention on that, by the way, you brought up the animal tab, the pet adoption tab. Mm-hmm. I noticed it's been live just a couple months. We've driven over 10,000 adoptions, probably about 11,000 now. It's 200 or 300 a day are coming in now. We're up to 10,000 kittens and dogs and stuff being adopted. So, okay, I'll take a video maybe of myself and my cats and send it to you.
Cat video. I got to love them. I can't help it. I mean, who doesn't love a good cat video?
I'm starting to sound like something out of a William Faulkner novel, an old guy alone in his house with cats and a bottle of wine or something.
Hey, are you a red wine or white wine? I mean, do you have a preference? Are you a wine-a-sour, wine connoisseur?
Actually, I used to drink wine. I gave up meat and alcohol, although that's about 90% true. I once in a while, like this weekend, it was the 4th of July, and I just got a real hankering for a big slab of ribs. And I went out, and it was the first meat I've eaten, and I had a margarita. And it was unlike me to have either ribs or margarita, but I have to say, I was pretty good.
We'd be happy to be a bad influence on you here at TWIT, because we're right here in wine country. So when you keep saying you're going to come out here to the studio, and I haven't seen it yet, but we know when you do, we're going to have to get you out and experience. We'll have to get you a little wine experience. But there's lots of great vegan restaurants in case you don't want to eat meat.
I've drank my share of wine in my life. Believe me, I just for health reasons, I stop everything like that.
Well, and that's another thing. You have actually bicycled across the nation. I was really impressed that you had your own personal, you take on any challenge, period, right? So you're not afraid to speak your mind and certainly try to make things happen. And one of the things that has really impressed me about you is you had a personal struggle that you had to conquer, and you did. And to support it, you actually rode a bike across the nation to support cancer. Talk about that experience and what impact did that have on you as a leader?
Well, I did have cancer 3 times, and each time I got done with it, I would have been in the hospital for 6 or 7 months, going kind of stir crazy. I would get out and I'd bicycle across the country, and it was a really fast way in 40, 50 days of rebuilding my health. And I'd say that, Samuel Johnson said, if you tell a man he's to be hung in a fortnight, it tends to focus his mind tremendously. Well, I spent my 20s either dealing with cancer or dealing with the aftermath and being kind of an invalid and it's really the greatest thing that could have happened. Every day is a gift. Every day since I've been 21 years old, let me tell you, every day has been a gift since I was 21. So, and quite literally, I'm knock on wood, I can't believe I'm here. I really thought, even when I got out the last time, I thought, well, I've got 6 months or I've got a couple years. What am I going to do? And I just kept living my life that way. And it turned out to be a pretty good good way to live. Some ways it led me to make some choices that other people wouldn't understand. I don't have a family or anything, and not terribly social person. And it also means, you know, Warren Buffett says if you're, how does he put it? If you're, it's a bad idea to marry for money in any case, but it's especially dumb if you're already rich. And by that, he means you shouldn't compromise your values in any case, but you really have no excuse if you're rich. I'm not, you know, I'm doing okay. So it seems to me when I see these social problems and I see, like on Wall Street, Fortune magazine once made enormous fun of me because I was saying things like in 2005, somewhere in America, there's grandmas eating dog food for dinner so that some jerk on Wall Street can drive a Porsche. And everybody thought that was such a lunatic thing to say. Fortune put it in big, you know, letters in an article about me as if that was so lunatic. But it really comes down to, and I think that that's become, you know, so obvious it's banal to even say at this point. But the point is, I'm the last guy in America who has an excuse to look the other way. I had fantastic parents. My family lived the Horatio Alger dream. I had Warren Buffett as my personal rabbi all my life. I'm the last guy in America who has an excuse to look the other way. So it's not like I'm, although some would say and have told me it's my Irish genes and I'm always out there picking fights. I'm not, I don't mean to be out there. I mean, I'm not a pacifist kind of guy. But I, when I see people beating up bullies, which is essentially what, I mean, when I see bullies beating up people, which is essentially what Wall Street is doing to this country, I think, geez, I mean, I don't want to pick a fight with these guys, but I'm the last guy in the country who has an excuse to walk on by.
And you definitely don't. You, and again, continue to amaze me. I'm excited to see what the Patrick Byrne Bitcoin version is going to be. Like, it's going to be called, you know, Renegade, like some, I expect it has to be some sort of sexy Irish name, right? Like, you're already working on it. I know you are.
I'm working on something. It's not a Patrick Byrne coin. It's something else. There's an even bigger opportunity than replacing the Federal Reserve with Bitcoin. There's an even bigger opportunity that comes out of this blockchain technology. And that's what we're working on.
Well, you can tell me. No one's listening.
Well, I'll put it this way. I think the security markets are so ripe to be disrupted by Bitcoin. The security markets, i.e. the stock market, the bond market, they are so ready to be disrupted by Bitcoin. And I think that if – I think you were right when you opened the show and said, you know, that earlier that this got away from them. I think that they're going to look back. Wall Street's going to look back in a few years, and these guys who have their senators on speed dial and their regulators on speed dial, and we know they do because we've been under their skirts. We've done all kinds of, you know, we're in this massive lawsuit against Goldman Sachs. We have this enormous amount of discovery. Can't say too much about it, but the connections that we can document between Wall Street and Washington are mind-boggling, and I think that they're going to look back and say, we should have gotten Bitcoin outlawed and 2012. And because they didn't, it got too much traction. And now they're going to look foolish if they try to stop it. But it's a really disruptive technology. And there's a whole bunch of banks scrambling to figure out what their business model is going to be. How are they going to co-opt this? How are they going to take advantage of it? How are they going to co-opt it? Well, the answer is they can't. As long as the Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies stay true to their principles of being peer-to-peer and not being, there are other coins coming out that have centralized institutions or federated centralized institutions. Those are not true to the philosophy of Bitcoin. As long as it stays decentralized, the bad guys cannot get their fingers over it. There's nothing for them to hijack. And I think they're going to look back in 5 years and say, oh my God, why did we let that get away from us? It's going to do such damage to their industry. And in the process, I think liberate our republic again.
I think you're absolutely right. So, okay, finally, piece of advice for those geeks out there or potential entrepreneurs or people who didn't have the benefit of having Warren Buffett as a mentor, what would your advice be to the 13-year-old out there looking for a mentor or older?
Well, first advice is that if you're invest in yourself. The thing they can't take away from you is your human capital. Invest in yourself. Secondly, if you're just looking for a profession that's going to earn you a lot of money and you've got the technical skills for it, go with data mining. Being able to work with big data, we're just at the beginning of that. There's so much more data available. Somebody who understands statistics and can work and code and can do data mining is going to be able to write his own ticket for the next 20 years, because all the big companies in America are now building out data mining teams, which 10 years ago, nobody even knew really, or a few people even were doing it or knew what it was, the credit card companies were. But so if you're just looking for that, go with data mining, like a union card that you're going to be able to earn a great living for the next 20 or 30 years. But third, if you really want to work on yourself, just remember Buffett always gives this advice. Well, I won't give you the whole story, but unless you want a Warren Buffett teaching parable, but it would take me about 5 minutes. Do we have enough time? Or you want me to?
Oh, we have all the time in the world for you.
Okay. Well, okay. Buffett, whenever he speaks at schools, he gives this Gedanken experiment. It's called a thought experiment. He says, do a class of kids. Imagine you could pick one person in your class to go long, such that whatever their success they achieve in life, you get 10% of for free. So you got to pick the person you think is going to be most successful, however you define success, whether it's happiness or family or wealth or, you know, recognition, fame, all that stuff. However you define it, you know, who would you pick? And he says, if you have any sense of how the world works, you wouldn't necessarily pick the smartest person or the best looking person or something. You're going to pick somebody who's just a straight shooter, who shows up on time, who does what he or she says that he or she is going to do, who, when they're on a team, they do their share of the work and more. They just have a certain set of characteristics. I associate it with like an old fashioned hardware store guy who runs a hardware store. It's just a certain sort of straightness. And you know it when you see it. I mean, honesty. And then he says, now look at take the other side. Imagine you had to pick someone to short in your class, someone to bet against. And so whatever they achieve, you have to give up 10% of that. So you're going to pick someone who's going to be a failure. Who are you going to pick? Well, you're going to get somebody who's a weasel, get somebody who isn't true to their word, who's a pathological liar, who cuts corners, who free rides on other people's efforts and things like that. And his point is, if these are all skills or attributes you can just choose to have, you can't choose to be 7 feet tall and dunk basketballs. You can't, there's a lot of things you can't choose to have 180 IQ, but you can choose to be the guy who shows up on time and does what he says he's going to do and does a little bit more and is a good team member and things like that. But so many people are, especially at that young age, are making different choices, and they make bad choices thinking someday they'll grow out of them. But he likes to quote Blaise Pascal, French philosopher, who said, the chains of habit are too light to be felt until they are too heavy to be broken. Meaning the choices you're making now, today, in your life, those over time become chains. And if you're making bad choices now and about what kind of a person to be, and you think, well, some days you get older and you get out of college or something, you're going to be able to outgrow it. It doesn't work that way. You have forged your own chains. So get in the habit now of making the, and really, you know, he proposed, like Benjamin Franklin, who wrote out the virtues he wanted to have, and then he just went and practiced them. And every day, you know, today was the day to practice honesty, and he just practiced it. And the next day was charity, and he practiced that. And Benjamin Franklin viewed it like building muscles, moral character muscles that you were developing. And then over time, it just, that became your personality. Well, Buffett tells a very similar kind of story. And in fact, when he speaks at schools, that's the one that he did. He just takes questions, but he always opens spending a few minutes telling that story. Think about the virtues you want to have. Think about the attributes that associate with success and what those virtues are. And then just start, you know, write, make a list of them and start practicing them until they become your character.
That's pretty deep advice. I think our chat room just totally blew up over it and they love it. In fact, I will say one of the questions that's being asked is if you're watching this show, you actually can see your office and your laid back attitude is certainly demonstrated. And you have this huge poster of Bob Marley in the background. Why Bob Marley?
Oh, one love. One love.
Well, there
I'm a one love sort of guy.
One love. Are you going to sing for us? No.
No.
Come on. Nobody's listening.
I dance a lot, but Nietzsche said we shall count every day wasted that we do not dance at least once. That's another life lesson.
Life lessons. You should like have, there's this place in San Francisco that makes fortune cookies and you could put little lessons in all the fortune cookies and it's really good. Just saying. Well, I would love to dominate your whole day and have you continue to share things. I think, again, I'm pretty inspired by the way that not only you lead Overstock.com, but how you're really being a disruptor in, with Wall Street, and you're a pioneer in the entire cryptocurrency space, and your passion for Bitcoin and what's soon to be the Patrick coin, Burn coin. I don't know. I'm trying to get it out of you, but you won't say.
You'll hear about it soon enough.
I want to hear first. Just text me. Oh, wait. Do you text? I mean, is that considered?
I actually just about a year, 2 years ago is when I started sending texts. I don't really want to be everybody's. I like my privacy. But just 2 years ago, somebody who was communicating with me a lot got me to start using text. Until then, I'd barely ever sent a text.
Patrick, my mom, my grandmother texts. My grandmother's on Facebook. She's like 95 years old. Come on. Just kidding.
Well, if I want to meet your grandmother, now I know where to go.
She's super spiky. So, well, I really appreciate your time. And if somebody wants to follow your blog, I highly recommend they do that. And that is your pretty much only voice on social on the web. And how can they go about doing that again?
Deepcapture.com. I do have a colleague who, good friend of mine, who is my presence on, he has a Twitter account. I think he goes by the name of Patrick Burns Friend or something like that. And so when I want to speak and I want to get something out there, I talk to him and he puts it out. So, but I don't spend time on it myself. And I don't have a Facebook page, but if you look for Patrick Burns Friend, I think you find that's my friend and I'm giving him the material.
I'm totally going to follow him on Twitter. I'm on Twitter all the time. I like Pinterest too. So I got to figure out, how to, you know, like eliminate some of the social presence for myself as well. Thank you so much for your time and being a part of our show today. And good luck. And I can't wait to read a book that you must be working on, right?
I'm too busy living it to write any of it down, but someday I might.
I agree with that. You are living it.
Tanya, it's such a pleasure being on. I'd love to come back anytime you want. I'll come out to, are you in Napa, did you say?
Yeah, we're in Petaluma, California, north of San Francisco. Have you been here before?
I love Petaluma. Great place. Good chicken farm up there.
We do like our chickens and eggs, that's for sure. Well, I can't wait to have you in studio. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Patrick Byrne, and that wraps up this episode of Triangulation, everyone. You can certainly stream this later. You can find it on YouTube and pick it up on iTunes. I'm Tanya Hall, and until next time, thanks again.